After the inclusion of the Hatak territories into the feudatory system structure of the Mughal state, the idea of hereditary transfer of power within the ruling clan by the right of primogeniture became dominating in the minds of the Hatak chieftains and served as a primary criterion of the legitimacy of political authority. The ethics of tribal rulers conveyed not so much the basic Quranic tenet of enjoining the right and forbidding the wrong. This is Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy an al-Munkar, as the norms of the unwritten Pashtun code of honor. In the writings of Khujal Khan, the general concept of honor, of Nang, is permanently touched upon with reference to the two fundamental notions, valor and generosity, which are regarded as practical arts, hunaruna, rather than moral qualities, for they imply definite social functions of a chieftain and provide ideological grounds for a number of customs and legal institutions. A kind of teaching program aimed at upbringing an honorable and competent ruler is outlined by Khujal Khan in his Dastarnama. This book establishes the scope of knowledge and skills required from an educated Pashtun chieftains. Whereas the Hatak's chronicle describes numerous cases of how these competencies were applied by its authors in everyday life. The views of the Hatak chieftains on real politics are documented in the chronicle not only within the large corpus of historiographical and autobiographical narratives, but also in a few ad hoc texts, among which two epistles, deliberately entitled as specimens of the Nasihatul Muluk genre, explicate the author's opinion on the art of chieftaincy, in particular tribal conflicts. Thank you very much for patience.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mikhail. That was a very authoritative and detailed read of some of these texts. I won't abuse my position as chair too much, but I'll ask kind of a broader question, which is if you could maybe say something about the politics of the production of this. So why do you think it's at this moment that these come out, number one? And number two, I mean, in this listing of the attributes of a Pashtun chief, is are the Hatak chieftains trying to write their own vision, or are they trying to reflect a vision that's widely held within Pashtun society at this point?
The second question, I think that this is a combination of their own vision and demands of the entourage of the Pashtun society of their time. We can't say that. And in any case, we may only guess. But I think that is a combination of all things. And the first question I didn't catch properly about politics.
The politics of the production of this. Why is it at this moment that you think these are coming out?
I think that the question is why at this moment. The writings in Pashto appeared. So this was the time when the writings of Pashto appeared, mm-hmm. It is interesting that these authors, these Hatak chieftains, they were only Pashtun authors, Pashtun literatures, who touched upon these issues, on the issues very close to life, real life, their experiences. Most of Pashto literature, classical literature of these times and later times, was just standard literature, standard poetry. I will speak about that tomorrow. Yes, exactly about this, and this is an exception. This is an exceptional thing that we find such information, such things in the. In the works of, first of all, of course, of Khujal Khan, who is, I think, Pashtun people should pray to him for his soul there, because he really is an exceptional man.
He's a national hero.
Yes.
Could you just introduce yourself as you give your questions? So.
Sure. Okay. I'm Max Gross. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand that Pir Ushan was the first sort of set the Pashto language to an alphabet, the Arabic Persian style alphabet. I might be wrong, but I think
yes. Yes, I'm going to speak about that tomorrow again. But I can
answer
the question.
Yeah, but that was late 16th century, and then Khushal Khan comes, a generation later, and this is the first significant Pashto work, I think. There may be others, but they may have been lost. Somehow the work of Khushal Khan has been retained through the years. The key question I have is, you seem to imply the argument that his ideas were influenced by the Mirrors for Princes literature that was standard in Iran and then, of course, among the Mughals.
Everywhere, yes.
And he worked in the Mughal court. I mean, his father worked in the Mughal court. Was he teaching something that was in intrinsically Pashto, or something that he was deriving from the various Mirror of Princes works and the values of Pashtun culture?
I tried to explain this.
That's what I heard. I'm just confirming.
Yes, I tried to explain that this, in my opinion, that this is, of course, this is a combination, but we feel in this text a strong author's approach to the subject. And everything he writes not in emulation of someone else, of some work, but what he thinks himself.
Coming
out of him. But these are general things, universal things, when resoluteness or honesty. So
yeah, that this scholarship, tend to think we should attribute ideas
this
to others.
These are rather universal principles, most of them.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree.
But there are some points, and I mentioned about that there are some digressions, there are some things that they are not, these things are not clear in the text. If you do not know the total literary legacy of Khushal Khan, if you haven't read the chronicle, because the chronicle, the Hadak's chronicle, give you the explanation, the commentaries on some things in Dastarnama which are not clear. So it proves that this is that was his own things, that he didn't copy Kabusnama.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a question, sir?
So just sort of following on this, because I'm a South Asian historian, so
Could you introduce yourself?
Oh, sorry. I'm Shekhar Krishnan. I'm a historian based in India, in Mumbai. Many of the concepts which you sort of explained, which are also derivatives of Mughal statecraft and sort of political codes, this is all happening in sort of the 17th century within South Asia, where sort of Aurangzeb and other sort of pre-modern, we would call kings or rulers, are also articulating this. So I'm just wondering about the historical context of Khushal Khan, if there is any kind of, because this is also when I was also curious about this. I believe because it's celebrated in this sort of Afghan nationalist, Pashto nationalist thing as a sort of national hero. But what's the actual sort of social, political context of the emergence of these types of forms of statecraft? Because in Indian history now, the sort of looking at the 17th century, this idea of the late pre-modern, but actually there's a communication of concepts across these different sort of regional states in South Asia, sort of, which are now actually we're re-examining kind of the political context of this and the so-called transition to modernity, which is identified with colonialism, but actually a lot of these concepts are quite, so I'm just sort of curious, beyond the textual and the sort of obvious Indo-Persian or, what Islamicate kind of cultural references, there, if there's anything specific to South Asian politics, in you know, whether in Afghanistan or elsewhere, where the Pashto-speaking areas, you could say.
Because that stretches quite wide.
It's
really difficult for me to answer a question because I'm not aware of this specificity of the South Asian politics at this time.
Because even in so-called Hindu kingdoms, what we would now today in sort of a colored way call the Hindu, like Shivaji and all of that, they were also borrowing very heavily from Aurangzeb, and Aurangzeb was borrowing very heavily from other types of concepts of statecraft and leadership, you know, in that sense, because this was the late Mughal Empire when things were sort of, the roof was caving in on the whole structure, actually.
Now, in this Pashto text, we may see only the influence of the Mughal imperial ideology, Mughal statecraft,
yes.
Not Hindu,
no,
not Muslim,
no, no.
Hindu excluded.
Right.
So, if my question satisfies you, that I can't say more. The influence, of course, because the Khatak territories were included into the feudatory structure of the Mughal Empire.
Right.
It was divided into two jagirs, so these were two feuds, estates. Feudatory estates, northern Khatak territories and southern Khatak territories. So the influence of Mughal imperial policies, we may see.
That. I was just, because the empire is fragmenting at that time, so I'm wondering if this birth of these regional identities and literatures and sort of things which are borrowing is reflective of, but I'm not really aware of the political history of that part of the Mughal Empire.
It wasn't fragmenting yet, except...
It wasn't fragmenting yet.
It was in the sense that this was a rebellion against Aurangzeb's attempt to centralize authority over the Afghans and to collect taxes rather than pay subsidies.
But I think framing your question, you're asking what we see here with your very detailed paper is of part with what we see with Shivaji and these feudatory kingdoms breaking apart, the central feud of forces that are pulling apart the empire in the late 17th century.
Yeah, and they're also articulating very strong regional linguistic and political identities through borrowing from the Mughal state or from text, selective readings of other Hindu texts or whatever. It's primarily the Mughal tradition, which is already kind of, I mean, I don't, fragmentation is a word to describe, but different things are happening at this time in the wider South Asian sort of the intellectual history of it is what's quite interesting.
My name is Michael Albin. I'm an independent researcher. Thank you very much for your talk. I noticed several times you quoted the two men as using with references to you can't rule without the sword and the blade is critical, those kinds of quotes. Was that characteristic of tribal governance at the time, or was that peculiar to the Khatak family and dynasty? Because my reading of tribal affairs in general at the Amit and Nas, at the general kind of tribe rather than regal tribes, is that the idea, regardless of recognizing the fact that there's rivalry and so forth within the tribes, the general compulsion is to dampen down and reconcile differences. After the revenge, for example, has been accomplished and the price paid, either in blood or brides or what have you, then peace reigns and there's no need for the sword or the blade anymore. That was is the Khatak experience a little more assertive in its recourse to violence?
No, I'm sure that it's not the specific feature of the Khatak way of thinking. I think that is a typical Pashtun thinking. I mentioned many times the word Pashto word Tura.
Ah.
Tura, which is both blade in the first place, this is the first meaning of the word, and the second meaning is bravery, valor, courage, and so on. So this the peace, I think that according in their opinion of Pashtun, not only Khatak chieftains, but opinion of all Pashtuns, not only chieftains, but ordinary Pashtuns as well, that the peace, that without Tura, without arms, so
but Tura, do you think he means bloodshed and beating up people, or coercion? I mean, there's coercion and consensus. These are Gramscian ideas. I mean, did he really mean just, you know, if they don't agree with you, go beat them up? Or make a twist here, make a twist there, deduct this and deduct that, increase that, deprive them of their resources? So consensus and coercion, or is it bloodshed and total peace?
Yes,
so the reason I ask this is this, because he has been in a very developed Mongolian bureaucracy, a very coercive bureaucracy. He knew what jail meant, what life in jail meant. Do you think he is conscious of the idea of how a tribe is structured? A tribal chief does not always beat up people. A tribal chief inserts influence by calling his friends and buddies to a council and say, this is what I ask you, you all put your hands on the table and say, we agree. And tell them, you know, we have decided you can't take his water anymore. That's it. So I'm curious about that. The other thing I would like to have you think about is Khushal Khatak's consciousness. Is it really a Pashtun consciousness, or is it an Afghan consciousness? Because he has a verse that says, "The Afghan Panang Mewatar Latura Nangyalai De Zamane Khushal Khatakin." And I've always asked, does he really mean the Pashtun Panang Mewatar Latura? In other words, does he really mean, does he, his understanding of his people, an understanding that comes from the West, from Iran, because the Afghan is a Western construct, it comes from that way. The other thing, briefly, if you have time, someone mentioned that he may be borrowing things, you know, intact and so on. The syntax that he uses, Pa'itifaq de Khalko, Pa'itifaq de Khalko, in Pashto, in Farsi, that is Ba'itifaq de Khalko. Now, in Pashto, if you really want to insist on Pashto syntax, you would say, the khalqo pa ittifaq. Now, what is going on here? Does he have something sitting here that he cannot convert into Pashto, translate it literally, so on?
No.
And finally, to think about these two key things, Sardari and Watandari, both classic Persian constructs. If you want to Pashtunize it, you would say Tura Laral or Tura Kawal, Watan Laral or Watan Kawal.
So, a lot of questions.
No, we're talking
about the questions are very, very interesting. This, the Tefak Pechalko. The reason is that the language. This is the linguistical problem. You have to differ, to differentiate between the written language and oral language and vernacular. And written language is not what is vernacular. And written Pashto language at this time was not the vernacular, and it was very and this was in many ways artificial language. And what you mentioned and paid attention to the syntax of the phrase. Naturally, this is not the syntax of the Pashto language. This is Persian syntax. This is an influence. There's a very strong influence of Persian written language on Pashto. Pashto could become a written language only when it Pashto authors, Pashto literatures, only when they tried to copy Persian way of writing, of expressing ideas in written form. So, yes, this is an artificial written language.
And he is an author of a lot of Persian texts. He himself has written substantial.
Not so much, I would say. Not so much.
Khushalkhan has
written in Farsi also.
Yes, in Farsi.
As for Blach...
My source for that is the entry in Encyclopedia of Islam by Rawan Farhadi.
No, Farhadi, I think
he's the author of the entry for Khushalkhan.
Yeah, I know.
Encyclopedia of Islam.
But we do not have these manuscripts.
He's aware of it.
Yes, but... Probably, but I do not know about that. I do not think that this is true.
And his grandson, Tariq Marasai, is, please, if you look at it carefully, if Hafiz Rahmatan was alive, he would go to him and say, please, this is all mine.
Yes, and what about bloodshed? This is, I do not think that this is a scholarly issue to speak about bloodshed. Because I said that Khushalkhan is a national hero, he's a Pashtuns,
may I express an opinion?
But how many people he killed? He writes about that in his
How many
poems.
People did he kill? Was he known as a lot, Safa?
Yes, he killed a lot of people.
Yes,
he repents in his lyrics, in his poetry about that. And he killed even there is no adoption in Islam. I don't know how to say it in English. He's a young man whom he took to educate, to teach, to what's it?
Well, in English. A ward or a client of some kind.
He tells this story of how he killed this young man in his diaries, which are included in the chronicle. It is a very nice fragment. He was a human being, and he was not a monument.
For sure.
Yes.
And this is not a scholarly issue, I think, that whether he killed or not. Yes, it's difference between what an individual writes and what he does. And of course, the same thing. Yeah.
My name is Hakim. I'm a graduate student here. I don't have a question, but I would, with my limited knowledge and young age, I will just comment on the concept of Tura. I'm a Pashtun. I come straight from the southern Afghanistan. What I grew up with, I was growing up with the concept of Tura, it is twofold, the meaning that I understood, both in school and in regular life. One is clearly, literally translated as in the context of warfare against foreign invasion. And the other is, it also conveys the meaning of achievement. So, for example, that could be winning peace, for example. Or in the context of revenge, even sometimes, the ultimate result, conceptually speaking, or in the soft form, they would say, Tura di wakra, or that's a tura, or that's an achievement. So it's flexibly used. That was my comment on it. And the interesting thing, I've read Rahman Baba and Khushalkhan. They use a lot of Persian, words in their writings. And I think it's difficult to kind of like really be sure of their consciousness in certain contexts. For example, like you said, distinction between Afghan and Pashtun, in their literature at least. That's not to exclude other forms of literature or the current modern debate around these between scholars or about these concepts. And so that was just a comment.
Yeah, this is a very complicated and subtle problem of Afghan and Pashtun. In fact, Afghan is the product. Afghan, as a citizen of Afghanistan, is a late product, the product of the 20th century, the early 20th century, and up to the first Afghan constitution, Afghan and Pashtun, it was the synonyms.
The oldest name in Tariq Yamini has the first instance of Afghan in it, but that is a Persian text, it's a Persian orientation. Then the extension of that Afghanistan, I mean, another spatializing it is also very, very Western in terms of its location, then around the Indus River.
I have no explanation, but so there are four main subdivisions of Afghans according to traditional genealogies, and one subdivision, the Sarbani, they in the past they call themselves, preferred even to call themselves not Pashtuns but Afghans, but they were the true Afghan Afghans. I do not know why it was so, but
it's in the eye of the writer.
Yeah.
It's in the eye of the writer. I mean, if you can write it, you become it becomes fixed. Who knows who was Hafiz Rahmat Khan himself?
We've got another question back here.
You mean Hafiz Rahmat Khan?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Look at this, the end of the late 18th century.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, first of all, I would like to thank you for sharing all these fascinating information. My name is Sita, and I'm a recent graduate from the Jackson School of International Studies. I also do some research at the American University. I would like to hear more about women, if you could talk at that time where women were standing and if they
or
holding any leadership position.
About women, yes. You mean the women, it's their social position or what?
Exactly.
So you see, I haven't said that at the very beginning. It depends on what, on your approach, scholarly approach. Who you are, what is your background? My background is not political science, not social science. My background is arts and humanities and exactly philology, that is text. I'm working with text as sources. And it's like in the courtroom. If you can't, you may say anything, but if you do not have evidences, written documents, there's all these speculations, theories are nothing. So I'm working with a written text, with documents, and may only comment on what are in these texts, and there is not much, of course, about women in these Pashto texts of in the early modern. This is early Pashto literature for many reasons. Of course, the status, because the woman in Pashto culture is namus. It is forbidden to talk about women. In any aspect of their lives, but in Khujal's works, we find a lot of, I think, not a lot, but quite a lot of mentioning of women, not in the traditional form like it. Like in love poetry or something like that, but some things that pertain to everyday life, and some things are rather indecent because he's Khujal Khan, he's Pashtun, he's not a Persian. He wrote such things that I won't discuss here. So, but. We may assume that position of women in Pashto society it was namus, of course, namus, but women played very, very important social role. I usually, to my students, I give such an example. How we call your mother tongue? And in Pashto we have the same Morane Jiba. Not Plaraneji, but you may say this, I think. I do not, because you are Pashtun. Yes. You are Pashtun, you feel it much better than me. But I think Moraneji, like mother tongue. And this explains everything.
All right, well, I think that's taken us right up to 2:30. So please help me in thanking Dr. Pelevin.
Thank you.
For a wonderful time. Thank you for patience. If you have any individual questions, he'd be more than happy to take them afterwards.
I'm going to expose my ignorance.
It's early in the morning.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the use of Zychronicles.
Yes, good.
I don't know anything about these. You mentioned the use of Zychronicles.
That was really.
Yes, he was talking before.